you know, humanity and other cultures would at least bear some intelligence.
Yeah, that the chumps would eventually smarten up. No, I mean, yeah, these are Ferengis that were dropped on their heads at birth. I mean, these are the Andorians or something, the people with the little antennas that wave around on top of their heads. I mean, these are the weirdos. But we've done it to another hour, John.
I was just going to say, slapped on the wrong end with a claw hammer.
Ah, yes. I'm informed, the Packids, P-A-K-K-I-D-S. And there you have them.
Okay.
That's our news ninja, Gene. What don't he know?
Right on.
All right, see you on the other side, my brother.
All right, mate. Thank you.
Thank you. And in the interim, here is the late, great Lowell George, reminding you, too, especially when watching Douglas Fife.
To you know, what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see,
yeah,
the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11,
oh,
11,
and most
11,
of the
and
amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes are going to be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up,
yeah,
all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Welcome to Conversation Radio's Lean, Mean, and Green Show, right here on the Horn. It's Foxed Up with John Fox, where we turn the conversation to conservation. Foxed Up is brought to you by B1 Louder Productions in Sydney, Australia, and CityNet, citynet.net. B1 Louder by ringing 877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 877-443-2366, or use your free minutes by dialing direct 304-6585. Host, the ranting, head-banging hippie, John Fox.
All right, everybody, welcome aboard to Foxed Up here for a Tuesday evening or Wednesday morning, Wednesday afternoon, all depending on where you are on this beautiful blue marble, such as it is. Welcome to Foxed Up here on the Head On Radio Network. And, we got some stuff to do today. A little bit of an update from Mr. Hari regarding China and Tibet from that piece that I read yesterday. on the three-point plan on dealing with China and Tibet, but we'll get to all that stuff in a bit, and some green stuff that the ninjas have sent to me. But first, we got the track of the day. And today's track of the day is from another great Australian band, the Divinyls, one of those Australian bands that has actually done pretty big things in the United States. And, you know, everyone knows them for, you know, that I Touch Myself song. And but we're not going to play that track. We're actually going to play the first track on that same Divinyls record. These guys actually just recently have been out touring again after many, many years out of the picture. And Chrissy Amphlett, the lead singer, came out to announce that I believe it's MS that she's got. And one of the reasons why they hadn't toured in a while, but they went out on the big day out this year, and it was a huge success. From what I hear, they sounded as great as ever, and the guitar player doesn't seem to have much of a guitar collection these days, so my good mate Scott Barry and Billy ended up basically donating a bunch of their guitars for the tour. How you can be a multi-platinum seller and relaunch and, like, not really have good enough guitars to go out on the road, I don't know, but hey, my friend's got higher fees for it. There you go. what is it that I have set aside? You know, I'm terrible. It's been a really, really busy day. Some of you may have noticed that, the Head On Radio Network website has had, a few operational issues as of lately, and I've been dealing with that, and I'll explain some of what's going on with that at a future time, but let's just say we're moving where it's housed, and I've been dealing with that kind of stuff. But off of what was probably their biggest record outside of Australia, just known as Divinyls, this is a track called Make Out All Right, which I think is a really great example of just kind of what a great straight-up rock and roll band the Divinyls were. So without further ado, kick back, enjoy, great band, the Divinyls. Make Out All Right. Roll it, Bob. We'll Well, there you go, the Divinyls. Going back to, somewhere in the mid-90s. I don't even have the dates there. And you can check out what stuff from the new album at divinyls.com.au. And I can tell you a little funny story. A guy that I used to work with, who's known as Kenno, monitor guy, was the monitor guy for the Divinyls throughout their heyday. And in the early days, Chrissy used to go on stage in these kind of Australian schoolgirl outfits. And they became her trademark. And after a while, just like anyone would, you get tired of cliches, and she stopped wearing them. And Kenna was getting, you know, messages from the fans asking why she didn't wear the schoolgirl outfits anymore. And she turned to him, and Chrissy, let's just say she doesn't hold back. She turned around, well, if you like them so much, why don't you wear them? And Kenno, being one not to back down from a challenge, did so. And for the next few shows, and very possibly the remainder of the tour, every single night, Chrissy would pick out an Australian schoolgirl outfit for this long-haired, slightly tubby Australian monitor guy to wear while he was operating. Kenno, you're a maniac. And, you know, one of my favorite lines from Kenno when he and I worked together, you know, he'd hold open the door for, you know, some women, as you would do, and they'd say, well, thank you very much. You go, well, it's the least I could do, because, as you know, I'll always do the least I can do. But anyway, moving on to some other stuff, just to touch up on or touch back on the whole Tibet, China, you know, torch relay protest thingy. I mentioned during the horn section that Kevin Rudd, the Australian Prime Minister, has gone to China. And these issues are going to come up, but it says here from the AP, Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd began a state visit to China Wednesday centered on trade, but overshadowed by disagreements over Tibet. Reports out of Australia said China had complained about recent comments Rudd made in Washington about the rest of Himalayan region that erupted into violent anti-government protests last month. A spokesman for the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade confirmed a complaint has been made but gave no details. However, the Sydney Morning Herald newspaper reported Wednesday that the complaint related to a March 29th statement by Rudd that it would be appropriate for China to engage Tibet's exiled spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, or his representatives in informal discussions about Tibet's future. Rudd also said, while in Washington, that there were clearly human rights abuses in Tibet that he would raise during his talks in Beijing. A Foreign Affairs Department spokesman told the AP in the Australian capital, Canberra, that China had complained. They haven't done it in writing. There have been discussions both in Beijing and Canberra at the ambassador level. The spokesman said, on condition of anonymity. To say China has lodged a formal complaint is overstating it. Rudd is a former Beijing-based diplomat and fluent Mandarin speaker. Some pro-Tibet groups believe that this makes him more amenable to the Chinese government, although it wasn't clear whether he planned to make a public statement on the issue. In Beijing, Rudd was due to deliver a speech at an elite university to meet with officials during Premier Wen Jiabao, including Wen Jiabao. He's scheduled to fly Friday to China's island province of Hainan for an international economic forum attended by Chinese President Hu Jintao. So it'll be very interesting to see what develops from that. Now, I read the piece from Johan Harry yesterday about the 3 points in which governments could engage the Chinese on this issue. And so from the Independent, from their open house section, he has a little piece here called Chinese Whispers. And he says, I've had a tumultuous response to my article about whether we should boycott the Beijing Olympics. The most reassuring have been the Chinese whispers coming from within the country itself, saying they would gladly welcome pressure on the Chinese dictatorship from our athletes to release human rights activists. It's a useful reminder that critics of the Chinese Communist Party aren't anti-China, as the dictatorial propaganda claims. We're on the side of the Chinese people against their oppressors. But I wanted to respond here to two points from readers that came up with surprising frequencies. The first was, you are in favor of setting conditions for the Beijing Olympics, but not the London Games. Hypocrite. He responds, actually, I think it would be a fantastic precedent if athletes pressured every Olympic city to improve its human rights record. If in 2012 Britain is still arming one vicious militia against another in Iraq, if we are still training murderous thugs in Colombia, if we are still letting U.S. torture flights refuel on our territory, or we are still sending refugees back to tyrannies to die, I'd love if the Olympic athletes of the world threaten to stay away unless our government turns these policies around. Bring it on. The second was, you described the persecution of the Falun Gong sects as a crime, but the Chinese government is simply practicing the kind of militant atheism you advocate in Britain. You attack religion, and so do they. He says, I find this genuinely bizarre. I have never met an atheist in Europe or the U.S. who is in favor of persecuting religious people. Not one. Every single famous campaigning atheist, Richard Dawkins, Polly Toneybee, Christopher Hitchens, Daniel Dennett, Michael Onfray, is passionately in favor of the right to free speech and the right to assembly. This includes the right of all religious groups to say or do whatever they want, provided they aren't trying to coerce other people. We try to defeat faith through argument. We are entirely, utterly against suppressing it by force. Indeed, we consistently defend the rights of religious people to criticize us. With some honorable exceptions, the religious are much more reluctant to defend our rights to criticize them. How many Catholics have spoken up in favor of abolishing the blasphemy laws, or Muslims in defense of the right for cartoonists to draw Muhammad? A few, not many. How often do you hear the religious scream for respect when what they mean is, don't say anything we don't like? As it happens, I think the Falun Gong have a lot of really ridiculous beliefs about UFOs, blood transfusions, and many other things. Some are even harmful. But I passionately believe in their right to choose to practice these beliefs and argue for them, just as I have the right to mock them for it and try to talk them out of it. I am opposed to religion, but I want to win a free and open battle of ideas, not crush my opponents with batons. Is that really that hard to understand? Beautiful job, mate. I couldn't agree more. And if you have something to bring into this conversation or anything else, you know, please feel free to ring in 1-877-443 head on. You know, I usually end up kind of barreling through this hour, but you know, please, if you have an opinion on this, or you're going to be involved in the protests, say in San Francisco, that'll probably happen tomorrow, or somewhere else, or completely disagree and think that we should keep our bloody nose out of it, bring in. I'd love to talk about it. You know, I mean, that's what the whole point of conversation radio is to have a debate. So, but let's move on to some green stuff. And Bob and I were talking earlier about, you know, conserving domestic resources for, you know, that are limited for, you know, domestic purposes. And you know, I brought up the concept as well from Tom Hartman's book that we need to use our limited resources that we have at the moment in a smart fashion, so we can develop the technologies that we need to continue in the carbon-free economy. And Gene sent me this post from The Economist, economist.com, and talking about bureaucratic meddling harming solar power. The post is called More Light Than Heat, and says, last week, the EDF, one of the world's biggest energy firms, announced it would invest $50 million in a firm called NanoSolar, which aims to produce cheap solar cells. NanoSolar believes it can sell panels for as little as a dollar for each watt of capacity, less than one-third of the best details currently on offer, or the best deals currently on offer. If true, it's great news, especially since it would reverse a worrying trend. It is used. It used to be an axiom that solar power grew steadily cheaper as time passed. Solar panels were once too expensive to install on anything but satellites. But as the technology improved, they became cost-effective, first in isolated spots such as weather stations or oil rigs, and later on lonely farms and houses far from the grid. By 2004, solar panels were coming very close to generating power at the sorts of prices regular grid-connected customers pay in places where electricity is expensive, such as Japan. Enthusiasts confidently predicted that solar cells would soon supplant grimy old power plants and spare the world the tiresome chore of digging for coal, uranium, and natural gas. Fans of solar power were so sure of themselves they came up with their own version of Moore's Law for the sun's power, rather than that of computer chips. Every time the volume of solar cells produced around the world doubled, the predicted price per watt would fall by 20%. After all, it had done so reliably for the past 40 years. But in 2004, everything changed, and prices of fossil fuels began to climb, and worries over global warming and security of supply intensified. Those factors might have been enough to boost investment in solar by themselves. At any rate, the riches that undoubtedly await the first firm to create cheap solar power were already luring venture capital. But governments such as Germany's, who wanted to give solar and other forms of renewable power an extra boost, began subsidizing wind turbine and solar panels in order to speed their adoption. This was supposed to have three benefits. It would reduce emissions of greenhouse gases, spawn a fast-growing and lucrative domestic industry, and help to lower the unit cost of solar panels. Thanks to the bigger volumes, indeed, the three goals are interdependent. Solar power will have to be deployed on a massive scale if it is to make much of a dent in emissions, which is which will only be affordable if it becomes any cheaper. But Germany's subsidy, which takes the form of generous tariff for solar power, has had the opposite effect. So many firms rushed to install solar panels in such profusion that the world ran short of the type of silicon used to make them. The price of silicon and thus of solar panels rose. Many firms began to pursue radical new solar panel designs simply to reduce their silicon consumption. Meanwhile, Germany has wound up with more solar panels than any other country in the world, a perverse result of such a cloudy place. It also has fewer wind turbines than it might otherwise. Again, an odd outcome for a blustery country. The German government has decided that the subsidy is too expensive and wants to revise it. Just the sort of unpredictable behavior that tends to alarm rather than entice investors. Of course, Germany is not the only country that subsidizes solar power, and such subsidies are not the only cause of inflation in the solar industry. Lots of silicon facilities are under construction, so an end to the present bottleneck is in sight. Several firms like NanoSolar insist that their wares will soon be completely priced without subsidies. And fossil fuels are also subsidized, insofar as their price does not include the cost of the pollution they generate. Moreover, tackling global warming is not necessarily an unreasonable use of taxpayers' money, but that does not relieve governments of the obligation to get good value for money. Fans of California's solar subsidy claim it will achieve similar results at a tenth of the price. Better still would be a hefty carbon tax or a strict cap-and-trade system, which would provide a boost to all lower carbon power sources, not just those that find favor with prodigal bureaucrats. It's interesting. You know, and I wonder if we're running into similar issues. You know, I've mentioned before about hydrogen cells. You know, there's the issue of supplies of titanium. NanoSolar, you know, I hope they're able to pull off some of these things that they're working on. Because really, if we can get this cost issue down, what's better than having something that for an extended period of time after construction and installation can generate, you know, free power? Let's see. What else do we have here? this also from Gene. You know, and we've talked about this many times. You know, Bob's talked about this. We've talked about this on the horn section, talked about this on this program. That, you know, there is no single silver bullet. We need to utilize all of these technologies to lessen the carbon footprint that we create, that we are continuing to create, and that is growing. I mean, that's the scariest part. And this is where, you know, again, I go back to my favorite thing, solar geothermal. Solar geothermal. We're not dealing with having to have silicon photovoltaic cells. We're talking about mirrors. So we're not dealing with becoming more and more scarce resource. And the fact that it is a reversible circular system that can produce baseload power 24/7. You know, I will keep talking about this, you know, until I go hoarse. Until I go hoarse. Because it's still, to me, out of everything that I've seen, is one of the most just doable and intelligent solutions. And for those of you that may have missed on this, in short form, solar geothermal is a bidirectional system. You have a large, tall concrete tower surrounded by an array of mirrors. The mirrors focus the sun's radiation at the top of the tower, which will heat up what they call amorphous ammonia. And the steam of that ammonia drives good old-fashioned steam turbines. Technology that is tested and true. I mean, this is how the coal-fired power plants run. They create heat, which creates steam, which runs steam turbines. Now, the excess steam is then stored in either above-ground tanks or below-ground seams. And when the sun sets, you reverse the process, and the excess steam goes the other direction to drive the turbines. And it is scalable for, you know, large amounts of baseload power, and it isn't not only usable in situations of, you know, day-night, but it can be made to be usable at the poles where you're dealing with seasonal day-night. And, you know, once the system is constructed, post-construction, it is zero carbon output. Makes sense. Makes sense. You know, we have a few of these plants that have already gone up. There's one in Spain. There's one out in the California desert. We're starting to build one in Victoria here in Australia. And people are seeing this as the way to go. And I mean, this could really, I've mentioned this before, and I apologize for repeating myself, but you know, I'm hoping that there are new listeners out there, people who missed when I've spoken about this before, that mathematically it's been worked out. If we were to take 100 square miles of the Mojave Desert and convert it into solar geothermal power generation land, the entire U.S. grid could be powered. Not saying that we go and do it all in one spot of 100 square miles, but it shows that this technology really truly does have the ability to give us real baseload power, which has always been part of the argument saying, you know, you can't have solar power because it just works during the day. Well, sorry, this blows that out of the water. And wind power is kind of sucks because what if it's not windy? Well, that kind of blows that out of the water because it doesn't need that either. Maintenance would be fairly minimal. You know, what? Clean the mirrors? You know, I just don't. I have yet to find a negative to this. You know, the construction costs are not insane. Yeah, they'll take a bit of land, but hey, I think we can afford it. Actually, we can't afford not to do it. But anyway, you know, contact your legislators. You know, Google. You can actually find if you go to my show blog at foxedup.headonradionetwork.com and just use the search and search Spegs, SHPEGS. And there is links to the open source project for this. There are some commercial projects going on. There's OSRA, which is an Australian outfit that has actually moved to California because they've got an investment there that they couldn't get during the Howard years here in Australia. So Australia will have to buy back Australian technology. But there is the open source Spegs project, which is basically anyone who can improve on it, just like open source software, can add it into the system, add it into the design, and no one's looking to make money off of the technology. It's something that the planet needs. So, you know, and I think that this is more of the mentality that we need to have when it comes to this stuff. You know, this is why, you know, certain aspects of the biofuels industry and whatnot, it's still trying to have you connected to someone else's pump or Bowser, and I don't think that that's really where we should be going, and having a purely profit motive on every aspect of powering our society. I know that that's all very kind of kumbaya and you know, very socialist of me, but hey, if we're going to continue to run our societies, you know, we're going to need to find ways to power them. So it isn't working towards the common good something that we should be doing. But anyway, I got a few things here that the ninjas have sent me, and I haven't even had a chance to read these, but it seems as though a uranium mine near the Grand Canyon has been blocked, and this is from Grist, grist.org. Post is called Deep Impact, and it says here, a judge has blocked a British mining company's plan to build an exploratory uranium mine near the Grand Canyon. Why is a British company doing exploratory work in the Grand Canyon? U.S. District Judge Mary Margoya agreed with litigious environmental groups that considered the location of the proposed mine and the risks associated with uranium mining, Vein Minerals Group should be required to conduct further environmental reviews before moving forward. Good on him. Because I've been seeing stuff here in Australia, and I know that this stuff happens in the United States when it comes to things like that, that word fast track comes in, you know. Just like Bush has got his thing with the Colombian free trade agreement that he wants, you know. Got a fast track. Can't think about it. Got a fast track. And then uses national security as a boo word to say, you know, if you don't pass it, it's gonna damage America's national security. Right. Coming up with a free trade agreement with a nation that's known for, on a regular basis, assassinating, you know, union reps. We can't look at that too closely now, can we? Just to go off on a bit of a tangent. And, you know, for those that promote nuclear power, yes, it has, you know, limited carbon output once running. However, the construction is extremely dirty. nuclear power plants require huge subsidies, and they're not as dependable as one would think. All you have to do is do a little bit of a Google, and you'll be able to find great reports out of Canada's recent history with new nuclear power plants, where after huge subsidies, they're not even online all the time. So after huge subsidies, huge costs, and sometimes 20-year construction processes, they're not that dependable. And then you add on the risks of dealing with the waste. And then the other part of it that I think just makes all too much sense to actually be part of the dialogue. Why are we going to set ourselves up to rely on another finite resource? Uranium is a finite resource. Just like petroleum, just like coal, just like natural gas. Hence why I truly believe that things like solar geothermal, straight geothermal, biomass. Biomass is another great one. Biomass, you know, when dealing with our waste product, which we have far too much of, you know, we've got landfills, you know, that are just huge messes that are just pouring out methane, which is per part worse than carbon in the whole global warming thing, although carbon is the most common. To be able to actually capture that and utilize it and burn it off to create power, the carbon produced by burning that methane is much less harmful by part than the methane just escaping. So, I mean, again, we're just like wasting what could possibly be free energy. And there are systems already in place that work. I've mentioned before, you know, New South Wales community set up their own biomass generator. The state of New South Wales, the renewable energy program that we subscribe to in this house, a large portion of the power comes from biomass. So if we can in the short term get cleaner energy by utilizing something that is a problem, it's win-win. I mean, all this stuff is very complex. Yes, there is no silver bullet. A gentleman who I think is part, if memory serves me right, part of the Environmental Task Force in California said there is no silver bullet, but there is silver buckshot, which I think is a really good way to put it. We need to be firing all these things out there. And a certain amount of it's going to stick. And we got to get on it. We really have to get on it. And I do hope that with a Democrat in the White House, if we stop beating the crap out of each other, we should be able to get in there without a problem. The United States will sign on to Kyoto, or the next stage of the International Agreement on Climate Change. And we can finally work together as a planet to really work towards real solutions. It's... You know, this planet will go on without us if we don't do something. But, you know, we want to still be here. right? Well, you know, if we want to still be here, we got to do something about keeping this planet in a condition where it can support us. You know, we've been talking about the oncoming food shortages as drought spreads to places. You know, the equatorial band is expanding. I was actually listening to Hartman's show from last Thursday, and he was getting into some of this stuff that, you know, as climate change takes hold, you know, middle latitude regions might not be affected as badly, but it's going to be the equatorial regions and the polar regions that are going to be hit the worst. And we have to be concerned with this stuff. We have to be concerned with this stuff. Because, you know, the coal that's being dug out of West Virginia and Tennessee and burned all over the United States adds to the problem globally. All the coal that is being pulled out of Queensland and Western Australia and sent to China is adding to the global problem. So again, it's this concept of sorry, Dan, I have to go back to this, but you know, the line of why do you care? Because we need to stop living inside our own little self-protective, self-centered bubbles. Why do I care about mountaintop removal? Because down the road, it affects me. If I want to be completely, you know, selfish about it, a little less selfish, it's affecting people that I consider friends in much more direct fashions than just the carbon that is and the sulfur that is emitted when that coal is burnt elsewhere. Pardon me, needed a drink. And, you know, as Bob and I were talking about before in the horn section, we need to stop externalizing. That is a problem. This has been, you know, that you know, it's not my problem, I'm too busy making money. That kind of immature, childish attitude has got to stop. It's got to end. It's got to be over. You know, and I'm really trying not to just go off in a rant because I don't want to. I really don't feel like screaming, even though that is my gut reaction is just to go off and start screaming. You know, how can you be so daggum stupid? You know, to go back to conversations I've had with my brother. You know, and we have some great conversations, you know. I love the guy dearly. And, you know, he talks about his biggest worry is water. You know, he lives in Arizona. And I try to calmly, which can be difficult sometimes, calmly make the statement to him that your worry about water is part of the global warming crisis. It's because of the changing weather patterns that the dry place that you live in that was dry enough, you know, 15 years ago when I lived there is drier now because the monsoons aren't quite what they used to be. The arid regions in the United States are growing. Ah, let's go to the phones. Good friend of ours is on the line. Alan the Trucker is on the phone. How are you, Alan? Welcome to the program, my friend.
Very good. How about you, John?
I'm doing great, man. Whereabouts are you?
I'm in Virginia, almost North Carolina. Southern part of Virginia, on I-95.
Oh, right on. You're not all that... You're kind of close to where some of my family is. But, yeah, what can I do for you today?
Are you still here?
Mm-hmm. What can I do for you?
Oh, I was wanting to tell you that... these solar panels, from what I understand, work better if the light is not too hot under lower light. Is that right?
I think it depends on the solar panel, and I think it also has to do, and don't quote me on this, it might have to do actually with heat absorption, that when the panels get really warm, just, you know, like with most things electrical, conduction is better at cooler temperatures, so when it gets really, really hot, you end up having a little bit more of internal resistance. I think that might be what they're speaking of there.
Uh-huh.
I'm not exactly sure, but that, you know, the fact that I do have some electrical knowledge, that would be my assumption there.
Yeah, there was this guy that was debating Tom Hartman the other day, and he said there's not enough light, there's not enough heat from the sun for to supply our energy needs from the sun. So I think I don't know, really agree with him. I think he was from the Cato Institute or something like that.
Well, I mean, there are still issues about the greater viability of solar as it stands, but it's actually to a point now that, you know, I mean, we're seeing, you know, places like Austin, Texas are, you know, spending great amounts of money to put solar panels out because they're even seeing it being viable with the efficiency that they're at now. So, you know, I think in a way it's a little bit of a non-argument. And the fact that solar voltaic cells are not the only form of solar power, as I've been trying to explain about the solar geothermal systems when we're talking about actual full-on base load power generation. So, you know, I think, you know, we have to use these technologies in places where they're going to be the most efficient. I remember, you know, many, many years ago when I was living in Arizona for a short time, staying with my brother, that virtually all of the university buildings and civic buildings had solar panels on them, at least supplementing their electricity, and that was back then, in a place that has a huge amount of sun. Why would you not get for free what you can? I just think logic implores it.
Yeah. I've noticed on the Internet that there's several companies now starting to get into the thin solar panels, the real thin ones that you were talking about.
Yeah, and see, that this is... This relates to that piece that I was reading before, where because of certain areas like Germany putting huge amounts of subsidy into solar power, that they're running out of silicon to get at the moment. So these ideas of doing the wafer thins end up using so much less silicon to produce, we're going to be able to create that many more. Cells with the resources that we're able to get at the moment, as we wait for more silicon producing plants and facilities to come online to deal with the demand. So it should end up being a win-win as these technologies come more online, and then as silicon production increases, then it's win-win and we can produce tons more at a cheaper rate, because silicon is the huge expense.
Yeah, and also, cellulosic ethanol, I can't really say the word right, but I found an existing industry that's going to be making ethanol in the future, and that really surprised me is paper companies. You know, the ones who grind up all these trees, make paper, they could also start making ethanol.
Yeah, well, there's runoff from the manufacture of pulp paper. You know, ethanol can be made from a whole lot of things, and this is where, you know, I have we're seeing the problems with corn-based ethanol with the competing, you know, food for fuel thing, that we can't write off ethanol and biofuels altogether because there are other ways to manufacture it, and if we can actually get it off of waste products from other processes, then I think it becomes a more viable thing. It's not in competition with food or other issues that we're dealing with at the moment.
Yeah, and hemp, you probably agree with me, hemp is probably one of the best sources for that, too.
Open up a can of worms, why don't you, Alan? Hemp is the thing that we should be making a mandatory cash crop worldwide. You know, building materials, paper that doesn't require caustic chemicals to bleach, fabrics that, you know, don't end up using, like cotton uses something insane like 75% of the world's pesticides to grow cotton because it's been, you know, it's just been so over kind of modified and whatnot over the years that it is really susceptible. So, you know, hemp creates fabric that is really resilient. I'm wearing a wonderful hemp shirt right now. You know, if this were television, I could show you. And it is the most, it's wonderfully soft. It breathes beautifully in winter and in summer. You know, it's insulating in winter. It's cooling in summer, even though it's a long sleeve shirt. And I can do anything to this, and it will come back every time. It is so much more rugged than cotton is. You know, hemp really is, you know, the missing link in so much of what we're dealing with, you know, because, I mean, cotton is so sucked in to dealing with outfits like DuPont because they need all these chemical pesticides and fertilizers just to get it to grow, and then you deal with the water issues. And, you know, there's a reason why hemp is known as weed, because it grows like one, and it's good for soil regeneration. It's, you know, again, go ahead.
So if we started growing hemp at a large scale, it would still be better than cotton in terms of having to use chemicals on it.
Oh, yeah. Hemp basically can be grown. Because of the way that it grows, it ends up not having pest problems. So you don't need the pesticides. But,
would you have to till it in every year, or will you just cut it off of the stalk and it come back up?
You till it over. You till it over. Mm-hmm. And replant.
Uh-huh.
And like I said, it's extremely durable. You know, I mean, the bloody Constitution is written on hemp paper, and if it was on regular tree pulp paper, it would have disintegrated by now. The only reason that it still physically exists is because it's on hemp paper.
Yeah. And what about hemp oil, like biodiesel from oil from hemp?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's more protein in hemp seed than I think in something like a pound of soybean.
I remember eating brownies when I was a teenager. Had to throw that in.
Well, there is a bit of a difference between hemp, industrial hemp, and the fun kind of hemp. But I did a program on this a couple of months ago. Hemp really, because it's been so stigmatized, and it's been stigmatized because of the interests of DuPont, is a huge, huge factor in that. You know, DuPont, you know, basically what is responsible for the chemicals that create all the pulp paper. And back in the 30s, they fought hard to keep hemp illegal when it used to be a cash crop, you know, government-sanctioned cash crop in the United States before Prohibition, because if the newspapers had started printing on hemp paper. DuPont would have lost all that money due to the fact that, you know, Hearst, you know, you got to go back and check out the history. Hearst is involved in a huge amount of this. You know, he fought to keep hemp illegal and convinced the United States government to say that the DEA doesn't have the time to actually check whether it's industrial hemp or psychotropic marijuana. So we got to just ban it all.
Oh, see, I had a right-winger the other day tell me that marijuana leads to stronger drugs, but I don't believe that at all because I've known people who smoked marijuana for like 20 years, and that's all they've done is just marijuana. They didn't go to anything else.
That is all such a load of crap. It's just not even funny. You know, and there's so much just nonsense to fight through to even have a realistic conversation about hemp in America, especially. It's just insane. Alan, I gotta go. We're running out of time. Ring in a little bit earlier next time, and we'll be able to talk a little longer because I love talking to you about this stuff because I know this interests you and you're so curious about what's going on with solar power. That you know, I always love doing this, and thanks for ringing in, mate, and you take care of yourself.
All right, you too.
All right. Good old Alan the Trucker somewhere there in Virginia, not far from North Carolina where my parents live. Somewhere up in Flat Rock. But anyway, folks, thanks for being with us today. We'll do this again tomorrow. Thanks to Bob Kincaid for producing today. Thanks to Scott Berry at B1 Louder Productions for the music. CRMW.net, Coal River Mountain Watch, join up. You too can become part of the fight of a sustainable future, fighting mountaintop removal. You know, we got to keep doing this thing. We got to hammer this home. Tell your legislators about solar geothermal, damn it. And as we say here on Foxed Up, be good, be green. We'll see you tomorrow.
And the sign said, long-haired freaky people need not apply. So I tucked my hair up under my hat, and I went in to ask him why. He said, you look like a fine, upstanding young man. I think you do. So I took off my hat, I said, imagine that. Huh, me, working for you. Shot on sight. So I jumped on the fence and I yelled at the house, hey, what gives you the right to put up a fence to keep me out or to keep Mother Nature in? If God was here, he'd tell you to your face, man, you're some kind of sinner.
Sign, sign, everywhere a sign,
blocking out the scenery,
breaking my mind.
Do this, don't do that, can't you read?
Membership card to get inside.